Michael.
Yes.
Oscar is out sick.
On a Friday?
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
Here's your soup.
Chicken?
Yes.
With the little stars?
Yes.
Heated to 180 degrees?
Why don't I pour it in your lap and you can tell me?
I don't have to be mean. I'm sick.
Ask me symptoms. I'm on WebMD.
What are your symptoms?
I have the chills. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling nauseous and my head's killing.
Checks out.
We praise the colorectal surgeon, misunderstood and much maligned, slaving away in the heart of darkness, working where the sun don't shine.
Goodness. Here we go again. It's a Wednesday afternoon, and hi, I'm Rob Snow. It's great to be with you. Every single phone line is available right now for health-related questions at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, or 1-800-580-CFRA, 1-800-580-2372. As we welcome back Dr. Barry Dworkin, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
What's the difference between morning sickness and royal morning sickness?
The royal, that's pretty much it. Yeah. It's,
Do a lot of women get admitted to the hospital for morning sickness?
No, most do not. The admission to hospital is based on whether the woman has responded to sort of out of hospital treatments. And there's different types of treatments. Diet will change a little bit. And also whether they are dehydrated. If they're vomiting to such an extent that they become, they lose too much fluid and electrolytes and such, and you can't rehydrate them properly.
Well, Kate of Cambridge, the Duchess of Cambridge,
yes.
Has been diagnosed, according to St. James Palace, with hyperemesis gravidarum.
Right.
My goodness, it sounds awful.
Yeah, hyper simply means a lot, emesis means throwing up, and gravidarum means in pregnancy. So that's exactly what that means. And it is very...
Throwing up in pregnancy.
Throwing up, hyper throwing up in pregnancy.
Hyper throwing up.
And it is it is extremely uncomfortable.
Like royally throwing up.
Royally. That's right, Rob. Keep going with it. It is actually it is a traumatic experience though for the woman at the beginning of her pregnancy, because she just can't stop. And you think about being on a roller coaster and you're nauseated and throwing up all the time and you can't escape it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're getting dehydrated. So there are instances where you have to admit to hospital. Other times what we've done in our office for some of our patients who've had that condition where they just weren't able to keep things down and they were getting a bit dehydrated, we set up an IV in the office and just had them lie down for about 2-3
okay,
hours.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
According to reports, people who suffer from royal throwing up, it's more common in women
twins.
Who are expecting twins.
No.
No? You don't believe that?
It's not a question of belief. There is no evidence for that. The rate of developing or having twins in terms of your actual odds of having twins is 1 in 700. One in 700 pregnancies, you have twins on average. So you have morning sickness in hundreds of women, right?
Right.
So, and the severity of having hyperemesis occurs in more than 1 in 700 women. So you're not getting twins because of having excessive vomiting.
Okay. I don't know. CTV News. Here's what CTV News says.
Yeah, good for CTV News.
The condition is thought by this hyperemesis gravidarum. The condition is thought to affect 1 in 50 pregnant women, tends to be more common in young women, those who are pregnant for the first time, those expecting multiple babies, and non-smokers.
Right. So 1 in 50 women, but 1 in 700 have twins. So you explain to me how you then to say that those 1 in 50 have a greater chance of having having a twin pregnancy. In other words, every pregnant woman can potentially have this condition. It's the point is that I wish these news organizations would just say, you know, we don't know why this happens. In fact, when you look at this, they still haven't pinned down exactly the reasons for why some women have it and why some women do not have this particular condition. So it's just take it for what it is. She happened to have hyperemesis gravidarum. Other women do not. Other women do. Doesn't mean they have twins. Doesn't mean anything. It just means that they had that particular condition, which usually subsides after the 12th week, sometimes extends a little longer.
All right. It's an interesting topic, though.
It's,
it is.
Well, it's an interesting topic, but you'd think that, you know, now that she had it, it somehow makes this somehow a... it's nothing out of the ordinary per se. There's no danger to the baby. That's the other thing to keep in mind. This does not cause harm to the baby at all. There's no evidence that hyperemesis will cause harm. It can harm the woman in terms of dehydration, but you treat it and she gets better and the baby is not harmed. So there really isn't anything with regards to the vomiting affecting the baby at all. And in fact, you know, you hear other things in the news talking about toxin buildup in the blood. It's like, give me a break.
Right.
Okay, there's no such thing as toxin buildup.
According to this report, they're usually treated with nutritional supplements and given fluids intravenously to treat dehydration.
Yeah, and they're given antiemetics or medications to stop the nausea.
Bobby in Ottawa. Hello,
Hi,
Bobby.
Dr. Dorkin.
Hi.
I have an unusual question. I'm in a situation, I need to find out where to get a 24-hour EKG.
That's actually very straight. You're talking about a Holter monitor in order to detect whether you have arrhythmias or
yeah. Can I tell you the backstory why I need it?
Sure.
Because I have a surgery for cataracts on December 10th.
Okay.
And I went for the consultation yesterday, and they canceled my surgery because they say I need this 24-hour EKG because in April... I had an attack. They thought it might have been a stroke or a heart attack,
okay,
but it wasn't. And the doctor then in April ordered the 24-hour EKG, and it didn't get done. So now they want it.
So what you would have to do is it's a referral that has to be made by your physician.
I don't have one.
Then that's going to be a problem.
That's why I'm calling you.
there's you know, you can certainly go to I don't know what to tell you. You have to go to either a walk-in center or something like that and speak to them, tell them what's going on, and have them order that test for you.
Uh-huh. So it's going to be a while, yeah, because I have the cataracts in both eyes, and I have trouble sometimes judging depth and walking off sidewalks.
Right. Well, no, I understand.
And I'm just wondering, is it usual to have the consultation so close to the surgery that you have to cancel the surgery?
I'm not sure. But what do you mean? Like what
actually? Well, the consultation was yesterday. My surgery is on the 10th.
Yeah.
So it's so close to the surgery that if something like this comes up, that they can't rectify it before the surgery.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but that I don't know how they operate their booking schedule and the surgeries. A lot of times the surgeries are done fairly in short order after you meet the physician. Just they do the evaluation, but. The other thing too is to speak to the people who are supposed to have done the test for you in the first place.
I called there 24 hours ago and I haven't received a call back yet.
Yeah, I'd still probably try and get a hold of them or just to go to, you know, again, one of the drop-in centers and say that this is a test that is required before your surgery.
Okay, we'll move along. There are plenty of phone lines available, by the way, folks. 521-TALK, *580, 1-800-580-CFRA. And Dr. Barry Dworkin is here for health-related questions. Sue.
Hi there.
Hi. Sue, go ahead.
I'm calling about my 11-year-old son. He's healthy. He doesn't have any ongoing problems. But he frequently wakes up in the morning and vomits. And he'll complain of a sore stomach, and he says that his mouth feels very watery before he vomits.
Yeah.
Initially, it's been going on for about 8 months now. Initially, you know, we'd think, oh, he has the flu, and we'd keep him home from school. And then by 9 or 10 o'clock, he'd feel better. So now there doesn't seem to be anything wrong with him. But, you know, it'd be kind of nice to get to the bottom of why this happens.
Have there been any tests done or anything, Sue? Or?
No, we haven't. We haven't done any tests because he seems fine after he vomits. Like, it's not an issue that bothers him other than when he wakes up in the morning.
He might have gastric reflux disease. That is because overnight what tends to happen is the stomach tends to produce a lot of acid. And if he's getting some reflux, and again, he's complaining of some stomach pain right beforehand, it can be irritating his esophagus and his stomach, and it can induce some vomiting. It can also give you what we call water brush. Water brush is sort of, you get this acidy, metallic type of taste that can happen in the back of your throat. Sometimes some secretions can be there. And so it just seems the pattern that you're describing, especially where he's waking up in the morning, he has this problem and he's good for the rest of the day, certainly would suggest that kind of pattern. And there are very readily available treatments for that to reduce the acid in his stomach. But, you know, I would take him in just to get looked at, if only to discuss that particular issue, because it is a prescription medication that's used to mm-hmm. treat it, and mm-hmm. it does work very effectively.
How do they diagnose that?
Well, usually it's based on symptoms, right?
So, okay.
you do want to examine the abdomen, make sure that it's soft, there's no pain anywhere. A lot of times, you know, in children, the description of the pain syndromes or the symptomatology of the conditions are a little different than adults. And mm-hmm. so it's just a matter of taking a history and again, following up. So it's not something you just want to take a medication and then not have anybody see if it's working or not. And also the medication is given according to the patient's weight. So
okay. I know kids get stomach aches all
yeah.
the time. And so
yeah,
then
but 8 months is a long time.
The doctor.
Yeah, but 8 months is a long time.
It's not every day though. That's the thing.
Yeah, but it's happening and it really shouldn't be. He shouldn't really
okay.
be vomiting in the morning. There's something that is irritating his digestive system and it's certainly worthwhile checking out.
Wayne in Ottawa. Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Dr. Dworkin?
Yes.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I listened to your program, this was a few months ago, but I can't remember the terminology of what you used. If I sleep on my shoulders, either shoulder, like my circulation, I toss and turn all night,
mm-hmm.
20, 30 times, and I can't remember the terminology you used for that. It was a symptom of something.
Huh. I don't know what context that was under. So you're saying when you're lying, you're getting numbness or something, or you're getting...
On either shoulder, and my circulation stops, and it wakes me up, and I haven't had a full night's sleep in about 8 or 9 years. I don't know what a full night's sleep is.
So is it
anymore?
Is it the top of the shoulders, or does it also go down the arms?
The tops of the shoulders. And I got to keep going from side to side, back, stomach, side to side, and it's driving me crazy.
Because usually numbness is what we call paresthesias. That's the term that we use is paresthesias, and that can happen if the nerves that supply the area that you're lying on are getting crushed or compressed, and it can lead to numbness and those kind of changes. But if you're having this kind of difficulty where you can't be comfortable lying down, you certainly have to have that anatomy looked at to see what's happening with the shoulders, if there's any damage, muscle tears, tendon tears, nerves that are being compressed. It just, if you can't sleep and you haven't been sleeping well for a while, there's definitely some sort of damage done to that anatomy that needs to be looked at.
Oh, okay. I see.
Good luck, Wayne. We gotta go and get the latest on traffic and weather, and then more of your phone calls for Dr. Barry Dworkin right after the 3:30 news.
Recently, they introduced the breakfast Hot Pocket. Finally. I can't think of a better way to start the day. Good morning! You're about to call in sick. Hot Pocket! Now you can have a Hot Pocket for breakfast, a Hot Pocket for lunch, and be dead by dinner. Dead Pocket.
They actually paid for that. Let's go to Michelle in Wendover. You're on the line with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Go ahead, Michelle.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I just had a quick question because my husband has a high ferritin level.
Mm-hmm.
And he works in a sheet metal shop, and he was diagnosed with that about 5 years ago. So they ruled out all the possible conditions that would be associated with it, but since August he's had like swollen lymph nodes, and I don't know if there is a link between the two.
Usually there isn't. With elevated ferritin levels, that can be from a lot of things. So certainly inflammation can cause the liver to release more iron into the bloodstream. How high was it? What was the number that he was given?
Well, in 2007, it was 537.
Okay.
And last fall, it was 750.
Okay. And has he seen a hematologist to evaluate the level and to make sure he didn't have, for example, hemochromatosis or anything like that?
Yes, he did in 2007.
Okay. And that was negative?
That's right.
Okay. So, I mean, usually in order to have elevated ferritin levels, certainly you can have inflammatory processes that can do that. Certain chronic diseases can do that. Okay. But other times people have these elevated levels for reasons that are not clearly known.
Okay.
The question becomes whether it causes any problems for him.
Okay.
And the issue with regards to elevated iron levels is that the iron can get deposited into various organs. So it can go into the heart muscle, can go into other areas of the body and cause damage, make these things stiffer and more inflamed. But if he's been evaluated and that hasn't been there, then that's obviously a very good thing.
Okay, now when you say if it was evaluated, the only thing they did was just take a blood sample. So would they know if there was anything, you know, wrong.
Yeah, usually you can, because there's a series of blood tests that are done to evaluate iron metabolism and how the proteins and the total iron and the saturation of iron, the binding capacity. All this stuff is done when they do those blood tests. So
okay. It
is fairly straightforward, especially if he was sent to a specialist to have that evaluated.
Okay.
Then you could pretty much be assured that that was covered.
Okay.
The lymph node swelling can be from anything, right? Because lymph nodes simply produce antibodies in response to, you know, you get a virus, you get a bacterial infection, you have any other kind, you get an injury. Okay. Your body responds that way and the lymph nodes can swell up. It's a question of how long they stay swollen. Usually lymph nodes will swell up and then disappear after a few weeks. They may come back again if you get sick again.
Okay.
So it really is dependent on how long it's there, but there's no specific link between the two of them.
Okay, good luck, Michelle. We have to move along, and let's go to Steve in Metcalf.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for taking my call. I won't use up much of your time. I'm hoping you can shed some light for me with my problem. The gentleman that called with the shoulder problems, I had a shoulder injury in 2004, and it was deemed that I developed bursitis from it. And last year, I ended up developing bursitis in the other shoulder due to a work strain injury or whatever. I did get the cortisone shot in my right shoulder last year, but my left shoulder, again this year with the cold weather coming, is just friggin' killing me. And, you know, my doctor says, well, try not and sleep with your arm under your pillow. Try and sleep on your back, but I can't sleep with my arm straight at my side.
Mm-hmm.
And I have tried Lakota. I can't handle the heavy topical heat liniment and stuff because it's just too much. But I've been using the Watkins ointment there 3 to 4 times a day, trying just about anything. But the problem is, like, it's just not getting better. And it's almost connected to my stomach because it hurts so bad sometimes it just makes me want to gag.
Yeah, that it's just that the pain response that you're having is doing that. Mm-hmm. There are two things that need to be done. First is for a shoulder to be that painful and causing this kind of distress, you should have this shoulder looked at a little bit more in depth. So there are sports medicine centers that can take a look at you. You don't need a referral from your family doctor to do that. There are sports medicine centers. Pretty much, you just have to look it up. Just Google it. You'll find them. That's the first thing, because that way they'll look at the shoulder and make recommendations regarding treatment. For pain management, there are some excellent topical applications that can be used that are not by prescription, but they're not the ones that you mentioned. So one of them that I tend to use and recommend at least first is something called Voltaren Emol Gel. And it's the only one that I know of it that's out there. So that's why I'm just using the brand name.
Voltaren?
Yeah, it's an anti-inflammatory, but it's in a gel that gets absorbed through the skin.
And well, see, they've tried to give me anti-inflammatories before, but the thing is, I have irritable bowel and I have diverticulitis, so those aren't even in the equation, you know?
Right, except that when you use the topical, you won't get those side effects. because it doesn't get absorbed through your body to any appreciable extent to cause that irritation, which is why I like to use the topicals, especially when you have older folks that are on all kinds of medications and you know that the anti-inflammatories may cause some distress to them. It's nice to be able to just put something on the skin that can give you almost, if not the same type of relief. So that's one of the ways, one of the things, and you can just buy that. It's cost about $10, any pharmacy. And for it to work, you have to apply it 4, 5, 6 times a day, because what you're doing is you're dosing. You're trying to build up a concentration of the medication locally in that area. And so you have to apply it on a fairly regular basis in order for that to work.
Right.
Then there are other, there are some compounding formulas that are used that contain all kinds of medications that we usually take by mouth that you can actually have made at pharmacies that you apply topically. So it actually gives you the effect of taking the oral medication without having to take it orally. And there are different combinations of recipes that we tend to use that can be offered to patients to provide you with some relief. So that I would speak to your physician about compounding pharmacy. I don't want to mention any particular ones because there's a few in the city and I don't want to advertise for anyone in particular.
Sure. Yep.
But your physician should be able to contact them and be able to develop one of those compounds, because your physician can literally choose any of the medications that we normally would give orally and have them make it as a topical for you.
Okay. Well, good luck, Steve. We're going to move along here. Radhika in Ottawa.
Oh, hi, Doc.
Hi.
I have SLE.
Yeah.
And I'm like every night I'm in a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't seem to control the pain anymore. So I was taking the codeine cotton.
Right.
But that sort of helped me. But then I have to, it helps me for maybe about 2 hours. But I find it's making me like dizzy when I get up in the morning.
Sure.
So I was looking for something, if you can.
Mm-hmm. Where do you have the pain?
Well, it's from my knee, both knees go down to my heel on both feet.
Okay. So again, one of the issues is there are combinations of oral medications that you can take that will not have the same side effects as narcotic medications. And so one of the combinations that can be used, and again, they act as starting points, right? So you would start with this and then you can certainly add things on. So I like to use combinations of topical agents and oral medications. So for the oral medications, especially for chronic pain, I like using a medication called pregabalin or Lyrica. And this is not a narcotic. It's not a pain. It's not an anti-inflammatory. It's used in conjunction with those other medications. It can be used with an anti-inflammatory, can be used with acetaminophen or Tylenol. And in combination, it sort of reduces the pain signals that are coming from the areas of the body that hurt. It also can make you a little bit tired, but you actually will be able to sleep a lot better with it. I've had personal experience with that medication after my surgeries on my knee and didn't require any narcotics at all. When I used it after my knee replacement, I'd used an anti-inflammatory and acetaminophen and Lyrica combined. It did make me a bit tired, but it really was quite manageable. And then, as I mentioned with the previous caller, that there are topical agents that you can use, especially for the knees, because it's very thin skin over the knees. You could get reasonably good penetration into the area with the topical medications. As I mentioned, there's the Voltaren-Emol gel as one of the things to apply to the knee, again, 4, 5, 6 times a day. But there is, as I mentioned, the compounding formulas that you can use that your physician can certainly inquire about. And they do tend to work reasonably well. The bases that are used in these compounding formulas are designed to take the medications into the skin, through the skin, to the area that hurts. And so you can combine, as I mentioned, a lot of the medications that normally would give you side effects wouldn't give you as much of a side effect and could potentially relieve a lot of that pain. But for pain management, it always is starting at low doses and gradually increasing. So with the medications that I mentioned, especially with Lyrica, it usually starts at 25 milligrams, usually at night, and then you gradually increase. So if the maximum doses goes all the way up to 600 milligrams a day, it's unlikely you're going to need that much. But it's important to follow things, because the central way of treating pain is using the minimum amount of medication for the maximum effect. So you don't want to create too many side effects and give you good relief. So that would be the approach to take, but it really requires your family doctor to coordinate this with you and not just to use the narcotic medication as a means of controlling pain. It really, narcotics are one tool out of many that can be used together with other medications to try and help alleviate your pain.
Last call for the Wednesday House Call. It's Edith in Ottawa. Hi, Edith.
Hi there.
Hi.
Doctor, I wanted to ask you about the osteonecrosis.
Yes.
Is there any way of proving it's gone? I've tried everything. My GP, my dental surgeon, my dentist.
Uh-huh.
My first answer was just x-rays. Wow. But it doesn't seem to go away.
This which area of the body had the osteonecrosis?
In the mouth.
So it was the jaw that you had?
Yeah, and I had bone removed.
Mm-hmm. For our listeners, just osteonecrosis, it means a death of the bone.
Right.
That's what it means. Usually, in order to evaluate whether this is healed up, certainly x-rays will show if the bone is healing. That's one of the major ways to really follow whether a bone is responding the way it has. What have they done so far? Like what has happened to date?
I just keep getting infections. I had a horrible infection to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told to take Flagyl before any dental work.
Mm-hmm.
I had two teeth. I went to have one tooth out. They took two. And I've since, after that, the bone out, and I thought it was healing, and I've been without teeth since about February. And then now they're getting ready to make my teeth,
mm-hmm.
and I have another infection.
Well, there's a difference between the infection in itself doesn't mean that there's still the osteonecrosis. The infection has to do with the soft tissue covering the bone of the jaw. And that's a different mechanism that's leading to this as opposed to the bone itself that's causing it. So the infections are likely due to something different than what was happening with the bone. And so what they have to do is try and find out if there's any extra gum disease or something that is contributing to these infections in order to stop them from happening and allow you to have the procedure to repair the mouth.
We have to go.
All right.
Good luck, Edith. Good to see you.
Good
Dr.
to see you
Dworkin,
too.
Back on Sunday.
I will be back on Sunday.
The Sunday House Call at 4 o'clock. And don't forget health headlines every morning at 10 to 7 here on CFRA with Dr. Dworkin.